This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 55, for Monday, March 16th, 2009, Rastafarian. This week we chat about RESTful web services with Microsoft MVP, Dan Rigsby, who's sometimes known as the Rastafarian. Let's listen to the interview. Dan, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you, Larry?
Pretty good. Dan, you've been on the show before.
Yeah, it's been quite a while, though.
Yeah, about a year ago we recorded you and Jeff Moser talking about blogging.
Yep.
We shared a lot of good hints with everybody, but what have you been up to, you know, since then?
Oh, yeah. Well, family stuff, work stuff. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. Been pretty involved in WCF stuff still. And that's occupied a lot of my time.
Well, you were actually named, since we were last on the show, a WCF MVP, right?
Yeah,
or Connected Systems MVP.
Yeah.
But with a specialty on, you know, WCF.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And you recently went to the MVP Summit?
Oh, yeah, that was a blast.
Yeah, a little different experience than a normal conference, right?
Yeah, there's not as much swag as a PDC. PDC, I came back with, you know, 20-some shirts. I think I came back with one shirt from the Summit.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to, you know, tell the people who run the Summit to work
yes.
on that.
Yes.
So, but you've come on the show to talk about a specific type of web service technology, right?
Yeah, you could call it a web service technology.
I always call it the other web service technology, you know, because most people are, you know, at least most .NET developers are familiar with WSDL-based SOAP, you know, or Azimec-style services,
and
right?
I love SOAP.
You love SOAP, you
mm-hmm.
know, but you're also passionate about REST.
Yes.
Yeah, so what does REST stand for?
Representational State Transfer.
Right. It's funny, I swear that I was doing RESTful calls way before we named it REST.
Yeah, you and about half of everybody else out there.
Well, I honestly think that I would be, you know, in a lot better position in my life if I had just, you know, given what I was doing a cool name like REST.
It's the same thing with AJAX. I mean, XML, HTTP request stuff. I mean, it's a lot easier to say AJAX, a lot fancier, cooler.
Well, Dave Bost actually talks about how he did AJAX before AJAX was cool. You know, it's the same kind of thing.
And
I've been wanting to write a blog post called Give It a Cool Name. That says that if you're doing, you know, kind of a neat technique, you know, with tools that are already out there, because, you know, there's nothing new about REST per se. There was nothing new about AJAX. It's just, you know, it's like, hey, what we're doing, which is a good idea and a good thing, let's standardize it a little bit and let's give it a cool name, right?
But also what's cool about things like this is they take these abstract ideas that are out there in the field and bring them together under an umbrella name, introduce them to a new audience, but at the same time, kind of wrangle things together a little bit, because you got some people who are doing stuff that you might call RESTful one way and someone else doing it slightly a different way, where there may be a happy medium in between or some ideas that this other person hasn't even thought about before, and bringing those ideas together.
You do have to put some concrete standards around it.
Well, there's no standards around REST.
Well,
really, but
you know, you do have, you do, well, when I'm just talking about the general concept of giving it a cool name, right?
Oh, yeah.
But let's talk about REST in particular.
Okay,
so I'm going to assume that everybody listening to the show is pretty familiar with SOAP, WSDL-based web services. Whether you're doing those in, you know, classic Azimec or whether you're doing them in WCF, right? It's, you know, the concept's the same. You've got a WSDL proxy to discover it, you know, then you're going to use, you know, XML usually, but it doesn't have to be XML.
Right.
You're going to usually send it over HTTP channels, but you don't have to, you know?
Yeah. I would go even further to say that when it all boils down to it, it's all about marshaling data from one area to another. And, you know, web services and SOAP is just one way to do that. I mean, we had remoting before that. We had COM before that. I mean, there's always ways to transfer data from one area to another. And SOAP built off these same ideas, and so does REST.
So what's REST?
REST, Representational State Transfer.
Okay.
it is an architectural style, not a standard.
Right.
Which, you know, that's kind of hard to get things wrapped around because it becomes very difficult to say, what is REST? But REST, as it's defined today, you know, came from, you know, Roy Fielding's definition back in 2000 when he kind of wrote his doctoral dissertation over a bunch of different things, but REST was part of that.
Okay.
And in there, he kind of proposed a architectural style for transmitting data that embraced some of these web technologies that we know and love. I mean, we know that the web is very scalable. It's been proven.
Right.
And how can we harness that to, you know, create a service protocol that can build on top of that?
Okay. And this is, we should point out that, you know, this is about services. This is about, you know, two people with what I always call a partial trust, right? It doesn't necessarily, you know, have to be, you know, a full trust type thing, right? Because, you know, I've got to have some kind of trust with them because I'm actually going to call them.
Right. Know? And we'll talk about some of that because anytime you deal with REST, I mean, inevitably you're going to run into things such as cross-site scripting, depending on if you're doing some kind of JSON stuff.
Yeah.
But
the simplest example of REST is I love to point to Flickr. You know, I have a Flickr account. Go to pretty much any URL on the Flickr site, and you can craft the URL almost like a verb, and you can get a response. And if you're in a browser, you see it in HTML.
Well, be careful when you say verb. I mean, when it comes down to REST, the idea of going from REST from a SOAP-based world is all about one thing, and that's treating things as resources instead of operations.
Okay.
In a SOAP-based world, it's all about an operation. You know, I want to
get customers.
Get customers. You know,
get orders.
Customers.
Yeah.
You know, get customers where blank. It's all about these operations you're performing. But with resources, you're treating things as a resource. So if I'm talking about customers, I'm treating customers as a resource. Just like a web page, it's some resource that I'm navigating to. And when it comes down to REST, I mean, there's a lot of contention about what becomes REST. But I've kind of identified, and it's pretty widely accepted, that there are four main things that kind of make up this idea of REST.
Okay.
And the first of which is to embrace the URI. You know, what we're talking about right here, the URI maps to something in your domain. A map is maps to some kind of resource. The second thing is your HTTP verbs are your methods.
Yeah, I was using the wrong term when I said verbs.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Yeah.
It's glad you shut me down, you know.
So I've got this resource such as, you know, some website /customer/1 representing customer number one. And if I want to get them, I can pass in an HTTP verb called get, and I get that resource. Or if I want to delete them, I can pass in the delete verb. So I'm working on a resource, but I'm sending it the verbs, which are my actual actions on it.
And we should note that the HTTP verbs have been around since the very beginning, you know, of HTTP. They were not put in there for REST.
Right. These things, I mean, REST is just taking advantage of what's already there. One of the nice things about the HTTP verbs, though, is you can make up your own on the fly. I mean, if you wanted to create a new one called
Run,
I mean, you could do that. But the only problem with that is it's not recommended because different web servers out there prevent verbs they don't understand. So if you've got this REST-based service and you're going outside of the standard HTTP verbs, you could potentially run into issues with web servers out in the field.
And the standard verbs are get, post. That's the two that most people are familiar
get
with.
Get, post, yeah.
Right. There's delete, and then there's a put.
Put. Those are the four major ones. There are a bunch of other ones out there, but those aren't as important for a lot of things. I mean, if you look at the HTTP standard, I think it clearly defines, I think, 16 different ones that are used, but there are others out there as well.
Okay.
And then the third concept behind REST is your content types. I mean, your content type is your object model. So in HTTP, you have these headers, and one of these headers is a content type.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to send data from one place to another, I can just define the content type that I'm sending it JSON or I'm sending it XML. And so you're defining in the content type what your object model is.
And web developers are very familiar with content type because, you know, if you look at, you know, the source of a page, for instance, when I reference a script, I have a type equal text/JavaScript. Right. You know, so this should be very familiar to most people who've done some web development.
Yeah, when it comes to REST, I mean, we'll talk about JSON a little bit too, but if you're sending data via XML or JSON, you know, maybe the REST-based service can say, hey, you sent this data to me as JSON, I can tell that by the content type, so why don't I return to you my response in JSON instead of XML?
Right.
So there's some little tricks you can do inside your service to make that a little bit easier.
Okay. And what's the fourth principle?
The fourth principle is your status codes. I mean, if you're doing stuff with a service or if you're calling a method, I mean, think about it as a standard method. I mean, you've got some kind of return code coming back, where that return code is an exception that's being thrown or if it's some kind of return value. Well, with HTTP, we've got these status codes. You know, you've got 401 for unauthorized, 404 for not found. 200.
200 is good. Yes.
All the 200s are pretty good. 400s are bad.
Yeah.
Potentially. and 201s created. So these status codes are your return type. So if you're doing a post, if you say, you know, you've got your website and you've got this slash customers and you want to add a new customer, you can post a customer to this site, meaning post, meaning add, and have that return back a result code, hopefully of 201, meaning created.
And you don't necessarily always have to return a return content, right? Because in the case of adding a customer, you might return like the identity column if it was going back into a database. But you know, it's kind of optional. It's important to make sure you check the status code because that could be vital to what's what the message is returning.
For most things like an update or delete, you know, the standard operations, it's wise just to return a OK or something like that. So at least that, you know, the end party knows that it worked. But for an insert, like a post, it's common to return back OK, but also return back the URL to the resource that was just created.
Oh, so you can find it again.
Yeah, so if you added a new customer, it's now customer 12, it'd be customer slash 12.
Cool.
That's very common as well. And WCF has a lot of nice things to add some of that functionality.
Oh, you're jumping ahead. And we'll get to that
just
question. We'll get to that question in a minute, but I want to ask you a general question. Why is REST important? I mean, if I'm a .NET developer and I've, or forget about .NET development, if I'm an enterprise developer and I've got great, you know, SOAP services internally, why would I care about REST?
All right. I mean, first, I like to look back at the history. You know, SOAP was developed and really came to being in the late 90s. You know, we had stuff with like the SOAP toolkits and other things that made it very, very popular after the advent of XML. And a lot of the soothsayers out there were saying, you know, SOAP is going to take over the world. It's going to be the future because SOAP can do so much stuff. It can do all the stuff that, you know, we were doing through RPC and other things before, that SOAP is going to be it. Well, when REST really started to come around, you know, things started to change a little bit. And now we're to the point where, at least over the last 5 years, REST has really, really taken off, where Gartner Group says that, you know, 86% of services out there are REST-based, and 31% are SOAP-based.
And they're talking about the 86 and 31. That doesn't add up, Dan.
It doesn't, because there's overlap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that the distinction that I personally see, I talk to a lot of enterprise customers. I talk to a lot of, you know, startup companies and all that. And generally within the corporate firewalls, you know, that you see SOAP as the predominant standard. On the internet, you see REST as the predominant standard, like by far.
And a lot of that falls back to the advantages and disadvantages of each. I mean, if you look at the advantages of REST, I mean, for one, it's all about reach. Because we've seen with web that we've got a lot of reach. We've got interoperability, we've got scalability, we've got all these things that make it so that it can really reach the masses pretty well. And there's also a lot less work. I mean, if you're working with REST, you don't have to have all this big SOAP message you have to interpret. On the client side, you can just take this XML or JSON and just deal with it.
Well, let's be honest that, you know, if you're not going to have some kind of client that does auto discovery and does the proxy generation for you, SOAP is complicated. And
yeah.
REST is a lot easier to understand.
Well, look, it's lower friction.
I mean, yeah.
WS Star, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in there, but it's incredibly daunting, the amount of stuff that's in there if you want to do something.
Yeah.
And that kind of falls back to the disadvantages of REST, too. I mean, I kind of identify the disadvantages being that there is no metadata. You don't have this WSDL that you can just discover this service with. If you're working with a REST-based service, you kind of have to know what it is you're dealing with, or have some other way for that REST-based service to tell you what it can do.
Right. And, you know, if you look at the traditional client proxy, it's going to create an object that kind of matches the web service, what you're expecting, right?
Right, because it knows what methods, what objects it's going to take in, et cetera.
And you don't get that with REST.
No, not necessarily. I mean, there's...
Well, not plain vanilla,
right.
You know, REST, right? So I can't go out and... Well, actually, we can talk about metadata in a minute. But the key thing that I wanted to get across, and you pretty much covered this, is that, you know, as you start doing development on the internet, you know, that you're going to see that REST is the predominant service. There's a lot of places that do dual-headed, you know, that they have both SOAP and REST interfaces to the same service, and you have your choice. But, you know, there's a lot of services that just flat-out don't have anything but REST.
But even internally, not just over the web, but even in your own corporate firewall, you can get a lot of advantages by using REST simply because of the HTTP GET. You can cache these resources on your web server. And, you know, whether you're using the ASP.NET cache or some kind of SQL dependency cache, I mean, you can trap this data inside of your IIS server, whatever your web server is, and actually have that render the data so you don't have to keep hitting your database and hitting your resources, and it can make your internal site much faster and much scalable as well.
Cool.
But some of the other disadvantages of REST, of course, are you're stuck with only transport level security. You can't do message level security.
Right.
Because there is no, you know, WS star stuff, which WS star offers a lot more than security, but you're missing all those things as well. And I think the lack of general standards around REST are kind of a downfall of it right now too, because you got people implementing mismatching different parts of REST. So people expect a certain thing out of a RESTful service, but it may not actually be there. Like maybe someone's implementing, you know, they're embracing the URI, but they're not really using HTTP verbs very well. You see this a lot where people have, going back to our previous example, customer/1, and maybe they put, you know, in their query string a delete command.
Yeah, that's actually, I was reading about this recently, is that that's technically a violation of what the get verb was for.
It is.
Yeah.
And you could almost argue that that's somewhat RESTful because you're doing something kind of REST-based, you're embracing the URI, but you're kind of violating these standards of what is REST. And
right.
If you're not aware of that up front, if you think you're working with a RESTful service, it could really bite you in the butt.
And a lot of people will delete with a post simply because of the fact that a lot of firewalls and routers will drop delete commands. You know, if the
delete
verb
with
is
a poster, with a post or a put.
No, do a delete. You know, with a post.
Okay, with a post.
Yeah. You know, pass it in and say, in the data saying, you know, hey, delete this customer.
And I think that's another kind of a shortfall, too. I mean, these verbs can kind of map naturally to our CRUD. I mean, that's what we try to, I mean, one of the most common operations is to do the CRUD stuff with our resources, create, read, update, and delete. You know, get's definitely read, delete's definitely delete, but what's your create and update?
Right.
I mean, post can be used for almost anything.
Right.
And it's widely accepted now that post is your create and put is your update. Data services, ADO.NET data services actually uses a merge verb
right.
to do their updates.
So now that's a great segue into what tools, you know, in .NET are there for REST operations?
Well, there's a lot more coming. I mean, when WCF was first created...
Well, let's talk about what's there now.
Well, WCF now does have REST support, I mean, since .NET 3.5.
Yeah, and that's the Windows Communication, you know.
Communication Foundation, yep. And the nice thing about that is, you know, WCF started being SOAP only, but they built WCF with all this extensibility such that they didn't have to rewrite anything to get the REST support. They just had a new add-on library, which is just a new assembly that was dropped in .NET 3.5 that adds this REST-based support.
And we'd like to remind all our listeners that, you know, let's start moving towards 3.5 SP1. It's shipping now. You know, let's get there, folks.
SP1 does offer a lot more, too.
Yeah. But it's, you know, that's just a, you know, we as Microsoft always try to push people to the latest framework. Well, here's a specific advantage of why, you know, 3.5 and then SP1 is a bonus. You know, it is a good place to be.
And again, what I've seen some people do, and not to harp against going to .NET 3.5, but you could potentially take the .NET 3.5 assemblies that use the web model.
Oh, Dan, please. Oh, Dan, please don't.
I don't like to recommend that, but it's possible for those that need to get around.
It's not recommended. So
definitely not recommended. But it's potentially possible.
So it's a feature of WCF. So if I have a service right now that has a traditional, you know, basic HTTP endpoint, right?
Yeah.
How would I start exposing that as a RESTful service?
With WCF?
With WCF, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually fairly simple. If you've got an existing endpoint, and again, REST isn't necessarily for everything.
Right.
I mean, but if you have a model that tends to be something that could be RESTful, like if you're just getting data.
Right.
It's actually potentially very easy. You just have to include the new libraries, system.serviceModel for the web, and then you can just add these new attributes on your contracts.
Okay, so I decorate my contract.
Yeah, so you take your contract, you just add a web-get attribute, and in the web-get attribute, you can define one of the attributes as a URI template, where you put in a template for what your URI should look like for this operation.
Okay.
And the URI template, you know, just derives from the system.URI template that was added in .NET 3.5, which allows you to map segments of a URI to some kind of domain semantics. Basically, what it does is you have, you know, customers/, and then you can have squigglies, so your braces, and then zero, and then an end brace.
Okay.
But braces aren't something you normally see in a URI.
Right.
I mean, that's not an allowed character. But what it does is, it, just like with, you know, your string format options, it sees that brace, zero brace, and tries to map that to something inside of your code itself.
Okay. So that would be like, you know, for querying customer number one, it would replace that. Okay.
Yeah, and, well, normally it would be, it's these characters are ordinal-based, too.
Okay.
So you could put it in with that comment, or you could put in the name and have it mapped to those particular variables. So if you've got a customer, if you've got a method called get customer and it takes in a customer ID, you can have your URI template map that.
Oh, cool.
So it's very easy to do. And then inside of your operations, inside your actual code itself, if you want to return back a status code, you can just switch over to the web operation context. In WCF, we have this thing called an operation context, which is information about the current operation being performed. Well, when you add in the rest stuff, you have a new thing called web operation context, which gives you the ability to look at the incoming and outgoing web request and web response and add to them.
Okay.
So you can add in a status code.
Oh, cool.
And one of the coolest things is, if you want to work with both REST and SOAP in the same world, all you got to do is say web operation context.current. If it equals null, they're not coming in through REST.
Okay.
They're coming in through SOAP. It's as simple as that. And so you can actually kind of diverge your logic inside your code to parse that out differently.
Is there anything that will automatically, like, you know, right now, if I catch an exception, it'll automatically get marshaled as a SOAP fault? I mean, I can control that, but by default, that's what you actually get. Is there anything that'll actually do that in the REST side of things that'll, you know, throw a bad error code? Or is that something you've got to catch and update the status code yourself?
You should probably catch and handle on your own, just because it's a better practice, but it'll try to do some of that on its own. And actually, some of the stuff in the REST starter kit helps that quite a bit as well.
Ooh, the REST starter kit. Let's talk about that. Yeah.
I don't want to talk about that yet, but the REST starter kit is currently in preview 1. It's available on CodePlex.
Okay.
And it offers a lot of things.
Put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, it's a great resource. They announced it right around the time of PDC, 2008.
Okay.
And it offered a lot of new things. I mean, all this cool stuff came out at PDC, but the REST starter kit was actually one of the things I want to look at first.
Okay.
Some of the things it offers are futures, which futures are basically things they want to release in the next version of .NET, so .NET 4.0. So we've got some other libraries that give us some of those .NET 4.0 features today.
Okay.
It also gives us new templates and samples for doing different types of things with a REST-based service.
Okay. So is this a learning thing, or is this I'm an experienced WCF developer, I know REST, now let me go grab it?
It's both. I mean, with the samples, it's more of a, you know, starter kit, so you would think, you know, someone who's coming new to it. And some of these samples make it really, really nice. But some of the things that it adds, one of the things it adds is a new help system. Now, we talked about there's no WSDL in
REST. Yeah.
But with the REST starter kit, they introduced a new attribute. So on your service contract, again, I mean, here you've got, you know, your service contract, you got your operation contract. In this operation, you may have come in and said this is also web get. Well, you can add another attribute called web help.
Okay.
And what that does is it automatically tells this WCF engine to render help for this method. And in this web help, there's one attribute called comment, where you can put in just, you know, any text you want. And what happens is it will actually generate a help system for you. And it's an AtomPub help page.
Okay.
And when you navigate to this, each operation, it'll say, you know, what's the URI to get to it? What is the incoming requests look like, response, and you can get all this data about it, plus your comments, so you can actually offer some help to your user.
Okay, so how would I actually see that? I mean, would I append a query string help to the URI or something?
Yeah, exactly what it is, and you can change that so it's not help, but or navigate it in different ways, but it's just your service, your base service URI/help, and it gives you back this AtomPub feed, which is better than just a simple HTML page, because if you actually change your service one day,
it's going to
the
AtomPub
will actually publish that, hey, there's been an update since you last had it.
Well, that's cool. So we've got In 3.5, we got the REST features added to WCF. We've got a REST starter kit. What other parts of the .NET framework are kind of RESTful?
RESTful, where ADO.NET data services is all about REST.
Cool.
I love that technology.
Yeah.
That's some really cool stuff. I mean, you can take, you know, anything that's using EDM or some kind of model that it can go against, like Entity Framework, and just build a REST-based interface on it. It's so pure and simple. And I like how they've taken a lot of, you know, what you would expect to see in SQL, like all your query stuff in SQL, and you can actually, through the URI, through a REST-based URI, perform full queries.
Right. You know, you can do sorts, you can do tops, you can do, you know, basically, you know, group bys, all kinds of things. And this is cool because, you know, it uses the Entity Framework as an abstraction layer, right? So it's not tied.
Well, anything that's iQueryable, I think.
Yeah. But most of the time you're going to see it with EF. It's got a dependency on EF, generally when you see it, it's got EF. This is a feature of SP1 is what I'm trying to get to.
Right.
So you know, it's going to be part of, SP1, you've got EF in there. It's got the abstraction layer that gives you the iQueryable interface, right? And what's cool is, by default, and this is what one of the things I absolutely love about it is, by default, it comes up with absolutely no access, right?
It's secure by default.
Yeah, it's secure by default, which is something that Microsoft's been saying for years, that our products are going to be secure by default. So if you stand one of these up, there's nothing you can query unless you go into the code and start enabling, you know, things. And it's got a very granular, you know, way of enabling things. You know, if you're using, you know, the Entity Framework, you enable it by entities.
Right.
So for instance, like customer, you could make, you know, read only, right? So people can query the customer. But orders, you could allow people to add new orders to it. Mm-hmm. So they can't create a new customer, but they can create a new order.
And it does support like the star syntax. So you could give everybody read access to everything very easily, but then fine tune who can insert an update to what.
Right. And so when I show ADO.NET data services myself to people, I never use the star syntax. That's lazy programming, because
yes,
you go, because somebody else goes and adds an entity, you know, unbeknownst to them, they're exposing it, you know, via ADO.NET data service. So the password table that somebody just added, is exposed.
And that also falls back to, you know, what account is ADO.NET data services using to access the database.
Yeah.
Because if you grant someone, you know, insert access, but that account underneath it doesn't have that access, then they're not going to get that ability anyway.
Yeah, and we should notice that none of this circumvents the database level security. Right?
Correct.
Yeah, you know, that's very important thing to talk about. The other thing is that, and a lot of people, you know, I at least I missed it when I first looked at ADO.NET data services, is this concept of interceptors, right?
Yeah.
You know, so you've got, if you turn it on, you've got access to, you know, these entities, right? So if I turn on customers and I allow you to update it, then you can, you know, update customers. But what the interceptors allow you to do is, using Lambda expressions, that you're able to limit what people are able to update or query. You know, there's several of these interceptors that are there. But the most common example is that a customer can do an update, but they can only update themselves. Right?
Right.
So the Lambda expression will actually say only the customer ID that's actually authenticated to the site. Another example would be, a customer can see all orders, but only their orders where their customer ID, you know, is present in the table.
I think that's the beauty of the technology from the simplest level. I mean, to set up the ADO.NET data service thing, you just basically create the class derived from the interface and the template, and you're ready to go. I mean, you set the security, but these interceptors add a lot more to it. And I know we did a lot with the interceptors with some examples we were playing with at the summit too. I mean, there's some really neat stuff you can do with that.
Cool. The other thing is that, you know, we've been talking about this being a RESTful service. It also, out of the box, supports JSON.
Yes.
You know, and you mentioned JSON earlier.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that yet.
Yeah, so let's talk about JSON for a minute.
Okay. Stands for...
Not JSON, you know.
No, JSON. I call it JSON too. It's JavaScript Object Notation. It's been there since, you know, the early days of JavaScript. And if you think about it, you know, what's the underlying memory model underneath JavaScript? Everything's inherently a hash table.
Right.
I mean, you got a hash table, and that hash table value can be another hash table, and you get these large, complex objects, which are really just hash tables. Well, if you think about it, you should be able to take these name-value pairs and be able to build some kind of syntax around them. And with JSON, it's basically, you just have braces that separate entities, and then you can have, you know, first name colon, then some value, last name colon, some other value, address colon, and then another squiggly, and you can break that up into street address, city, state, zip. And you've got this huge object model that you can represent with a very slim notation. It's much lighter weight than XML because you don't have these heavy tags everywhere.
Yeah, I've done a lot of tests on this, and it's generally like, you know, 30, 40, sometimes even 50. It depends on the actual data structures that you got and the XML, how verbose it is. But it can be like, you know, 30% smaller.
Yeah, and that actually means it's faster to serialize too.
Right.
Because one of the things when they switched over to the data contract serializer in .NET 3.0 was that they noticed at least a 10% performance increase because everything was implicitly a node. You didn't have to worry about someone saying, oh, this is going to be an attribute now,
right,
and changing your model. They could strip out all the attribute stuff. And the same thing with the JSON serializer. They know it's going to be basically the equivalent of a node, and it can be much faster to serialize.
So with ADO.NET Data Services, and actually this is a feature of WCF too, JSON is kind of independent of REST, right? Because you can ask.
Oh, yeah. And JSON, one of the other nice things about JSON too is, you know, JavaScript naturally understands it.
Yeah.
If I give it this JSON object and I say, you know, object.firstname, and if it's there, great. It sees it and you can access it just like anything else. Or if I say object.age and it doesn't have an age, it just returns back undefined like you would expect with any other JavaScript object. So if you're using, you know, JSON in the web world, you don't have to have some kind of XML interpreter inside of JavaScript. It just naturally understands it. There's no interpretation level necessary.
And see, that's the key difference here, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, because there's a lot of people who are like, God, why would you use anything else if you have XML? XML is absolutely beautiful. One of the jokes on our show is that, oh, if it's done in XML, it has to be good, you know? You're looking at me like, what? You know, but it is, right? People think that, oh, it's XML, so it must be perfect.
And
right?
I dream in angle brackets, so don't get me wrong.
Oh, dude, that's sick.
But you do have to be careful. I mean, XML is good, and JSON is good too, but coming back to what I said earlier, you've got cross-site scripting issues.
Yeah.
A lot of web browsers, if you're pulling in JSON that's not on your own domain, you're going to get errors, and you have to handle those.
But the real benefit of JSON as your serialization format is the fact that if your web browser is the target, mm-hmm. there's no parsing on the client side. I mean, it's just like understood.
Right.
And that's the key thing, right? Is if you're being consumed by a program, you know, probably XML is the way to go, right? It's a little more structured. It's just kind of a, you know, better if you're going to write code against it, right? But if you're going to just slide something into the browsing experience, absolutely JSON's the way to go.
Yeah, and come back to the cross-site scripting issues, that can be a problem, but I've seen what a lot of people do is, you know, you may consume an external REST-based service, and that may be XML, and then you kind of put a shim on it internally just to serve it up to your own web pages that returns back that JSON. So that way the pages themselves are very quick.
Yeah, I think there's actually a jQuery plugin that'll actually take XML and turn it into JSON, you know, locally to the client. So,
but still, there's that overhead of doing that conversion.
Oh yeah, there's absolutely the overhead. But so, Dan, obviously, your passion about REST is coming through. Anything else to share on the topic?
Well, we didn't even talk about a lot of what WCF's doing with REST. I mean, we talked about
Let's talk about it.
We talked about the WebGit attribute.
Yeah.
WebGit is just for gits, because one of the tenets, the first tenet I said about REST was, you know, embrace the URI, but Git is special. You know, 99.9% of all traffic out there is a Git. I mean, you get stuff all the time, but you very rarely actually insert or update or delete it. So with WCF, they wanted to treat Git special as well. So the web Git attribute is only for Gits. So you have a URI template, and it's all about the Gits. If you want to do any other verbs, you have to use web invoke attribute.
Okay.
And the web invoke attribute, you have to implement a method. It's just a method attribute, and you can put in post, put, you know, simply type it in.
Okay.
What's interesting is you can't put in a git.
Because they want to go back to the web git attribute, yeah.
And it's also very easy. You can, from this attribute too, you can say that the response type or request type is JSON or XML.
Okay.
We support either of those right now, so you don't have to worry about. If you're returning back, if you have a Git and if you have a current WCF service today and it returns back, let's say, a customer object, all you got to do is when you add this web Git attribute on your operation contract, it's automatically going to assume it's going to be XML and it's going to return back XML. But if you want it to return back, you know, JSON, you just change this request type to be JSON and you're ready to go.
Cool.
And that's kind of neat. A couple of other things are coming out of the REST Starter Kit as well. The REST Starter Kit added in, we talked about the web help. One of the other things it really added in was these request interceptors. And they call them request interceptors because they come in very early in the pipeline. So you can actually get at the request before it goes to this entire WCF stack.
Okay.
And what they've done with that is they've added in a few hints that you can do inside of the REST Starter Kit. One of those is an API key. Now, if you go to a lot of these REST services out there today,
you see these on a lot of sites that do that do metering or whatever, or you know, if you call, for instance, the mapping and virtual Earth platform, you know, there's a key that you need because they limit, you know, or they limit you to X number of tiles that you pull down, or more importantly, you know, that, you know, if you've got an account, you know, that has unlimited access, they want to make sure it's you doing it.
Right. And there's the throttling, too. I mean, maybe you have a free service and you grant people, you know, 1,000 times a month you can have access.
Oh, geez, we haven't even talked about Twitter and its throttling, right? I mean,
yeah.
So that could be an instance where...
Same type of thing. But it's very common to have an API key where you'd put, like, a GUID that you'd give someone. So someone registers on your site to use your REST-based service.
Yep.
Once they do that, you give them a GUID. And every request that they make, they just have to append this in the URI string.
Right.
So somewhere up there, they could have in the query string, you know, ampersand key equals my GUID.
Right.
And you could require that for your service. Or you could say, if you don't have a key, you know, only give them very limited access. But by using this request interceptor, you can actually check for that API key before it hits this huge WCF stack. So if you got someone pounding your server when they really shouldn't be doing anything, it's going to be very efficient at how it handles that. And you can actually do that check of, you know, verifying this API key that it really exists in your database or whatever and do all that checking up front. And in the REST Starter Kit, they have examples about how to use this API key.
And then what you could do is you could immediately, rather than light up the whole stack, you could throw a status code of, you know 400
yeah,
something,
and
right?
And you can return, you know, HTML and other things, too, to actually say, you know, we expect there to be a key, and here's the format. And, of course, return back some kind of status code.
Or just simply stop it, dude.
Yeah, quit it. We've had enough. One of the other cool things they really added, too, is the caching support. And we talked about, you know, how you can now add this web help attribute.
Right.
You can now add a web cache attribute
okay. To
your operation context. And what that actually does is it allows you to take advantage of a lot of the ASP.NET caching mechanisms out there. We talked about you know, having your gets and cache your pages by IIS or your web server, but how do you go about doing that? And this web cache is a great way to do that. You can set up, you know, cache dependencies where you could say cache this resource for 5 minutes.
Okay.
Which means every time someone hits this operation or this particular URI, you know, customer number one, for instance, it's not going to go to your service. It's not even going to go to your database. It's just going to return back this XML or JSON data that represents customer one.
So if I have a high accessed service, but with low volatility,
right?
You know, things that don't change often, but a lot of people
like
hit them.
The number of countries in the world. I mean, the country list doesn't change very often.
Right. So you could cache that for 5 minutes and not have a problem. You know.
Probably. I mean, there's enough rebellions here and there, but I think you'll be all right every 5 minutes.
Yeah, when
every day.
When we talk about scalability and arc ready, you know, last year my joke was the states table.
Yeah.
You know, there's no need to actually hit the database on every page to get the states table. You know, that's ridiculous because we're going to have plenty of warning if we add a 51st state, right?
Or lose a state. I think there's a couple states that have in their constitution that they're allowed to secede.
Oh, that's a joke because it's Texas.
Oh, Texas?
Yes. And I grew up in Texas, you know, and we had to do Texas history in seventh grade and all that. And there's this rumor that Texas can leave or become five states. And they said it's like this antiquated thing. It could never, you know, it could never truly happen. You know,
boy, Alaska is big enough we could break it up into two states.
And you can learn about history on the Thirsty Developer podcast, can't
yes,
you? Yeah.
You can.
So yeah, it just happened to be that one of your hosts was born in Abilene, Texas.
But caching can really add a lot of scalability to your site, and it's definitely something you want to look at. I mean, not just, you know, hitting it a lot, but I mean, even if you have volatile data, we have these things in SQL Server 2005 that you can implement with these SQL dependency caches.
Right.
And ASP.NET.
So it'll invalidate the cache if the data changes.
If the table changes, then invalidate the cache. So you're not caching it for, you know, 5 minutes or 1 day. You're just saying keep it in the cache once it's been accessed until the data in the database changes.
Right.
Then once that happens, then actually update the actual page.
Cool. And all that plugs right into the WCF infrastructure.
Oh, yeah, and it's very easy because it's just an attribute.
Will that work for web service calls other than REST, or is this is a REST-specific feature?
Well, it's REST-specific because it's harnessing that ASP.NET caching engine.
Okay.
And it's going to be the web server, because you can actually tell it on there, where do you want it to be cached? Do you want to cache the page on the service or on IIS or on a router or on all of them?
Okay.
So you can actually fine-tune the level of where that stuff's being cached, because you could cache it even outside of your web server itself on some kind of external router.
Cool. Anything else you want to talk about today?
I think that's the majority. I don't want to overwhelm people. I mean, REST in its purest form is pretty simple, but it can get pretty deep.
Well, we can have you back on in a month or so, you know, if you got more to say then. So, Dan, you're welcome on the Thirsty Developer anytime.
Yeah,
but I want to thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com or send us a message on our new Twitter account, twitter.com/thirstyd.